This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. Voluntourism is the current practice of young people coming from first world countries to volunteer in their third world nations, often paying large amounts of money to do so, but in the process, possibly doing more harm than good. I'm not sure whether, you know, that question is really a fair one, but with me and helping me to understand what voluntourism today is, Martin Stevenson. He's a journalist and travel writer. Martin's actually the author of the book titled More Than Footprints. Welcome to the show, Martin. How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
You know, what got you involved in all of this? I understand you travelled with your father. You went as a backpacker. And that sort of changed your whole perception of travel, didn't it? And how old were you at that stage?
I was 14.
You were 14, yeah.
And yeah, Dad took my brother and I out of school for 3 months. And people travel for many noble reasons, but it was on that trip, sitting on a sand dune, looking out over the Bay of Plenty, 20,000 kilometers from double maths, that I realized that travel was just a lot more fun than whatever it was you were supposed to be doing.
You're right.
And that was it. And that was when the bug bit, and I've been doing it ever since.
Yeah, you went back to school, obviously, after 3 months.
Yes, mm-hmm. I made it back.
And when you finished school, how did you embark on this path?
Interrailing first. Interrailing is very popular in Europe. But you buy a one-off ticket for the month, and it covers every train in Europe. At the time, it was only, quick conversion, 600 ringgit for 1 month, every train in Europe, and you could just get on and get off anytime you liked.
Right.
Now it's a lot more expensive, but it's still a great way to start traveling.
Yeah, well, with inflation and stuff, I suppose. You
know. Yes, and various sort of countries whacking their own surcharges onto the prices and stuff.
Which is something you have a problem with, I'm sure. And, you know, you address a lot of these things in the book, More Than Footprints. It was very, very interesting, Martin. It was very much centered around the backpacker and the impact of the backpacker on the tourism industry in places in general. In this side of the world, you don't have as many people backpacking as opposed to, in European countries or even in Australia or New Zealand.
Right.
There is something that's holding us back. I think it's safety more than anything else.
Right.
We're very comfortable where we are, right?
Yeah, why not? That's why we come here.
But yeah, what was the motivation of bringing out the role of the backpacker in the travel industry?
It's something that simply isn't understood. And when you've been on a holiday, I know most of us have come back from a place. Maybe say, like, okay, I've just spent 6 months in Goa, and somebody else says, oh, it was much better when I was there 10 years ago, less developed. And what we should say to them is
you hear that
all the time. And what they don't realize, it was the money they spent 10 years ago that funded the development that they're complaining about now, which is the first thing we should say to them. And what people don't realize is the growth of backpacking and the impact of backpacking. And most countries, when we visit them, they lump us in with other tourists. When you have your arrivals card as you're coming in on the plane, you just tick tourist. But Australia gives an extra box for the backpacker because the Australian Tourism Commission says that we stay longer, travel further, and spend more than any other kind of tourist. And this year, 550,000 backpackers will visit Australia. They'll stay an average 83 nights, and they'll spend $3.3 billion between them.
And a year?
Yeah.
$3.3 billion Aussie dollars a year.
Yeah. Yes.
US dollars, Aussie dollars.
They're about the same.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's something that backpackers don't realize, because our perception of backpackers, the picture we have, is a long-haired hippie who's trying to save his pennies and sleeping wherever they can,
slippers wherever they go.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's still kind of true, but it's in our numbers, our combined impact on places,
and the duration that you stay,
and the amount of time that we stay. Now this is both bad and good, because the guidebook market for backpackers is a lot like the computer market. There are two models that anybody uses, Lonely Planet or Rough Guides. So we're all going to the same places, we arrive at the same page, and we're spending our money on the same goods and services. Now this can be negative if we're spending it in the wrong way, but it can also be very positive, because I'm a huge advocate of backpacking over mass tourism, because the money we spend stays in local pockets. We stay in locally owned hostels, we eat in locally owned restaurants, and one of the problems, which I'm sure we'll get onto today, but one of the problems with the mass tourism industry is leakage, where the money that you spend on your holiday doesn't necessarily benefit local people. whereas backpackers at the moment are benefiting local people. And one of the things that I discuss in the book is how the backpacking market is beginning to consolidate, and you're seeing these big international backpacking organizations mm-hmm. appear, and the money is maybe not getting to the people that we have traditionally benefited yeah. at a local level.
Is that because backpacking has become an industry in its own right now?
Yes.
Anything in large numbers starts to become an industry.
Well, absolutely, yeah. You have companies like in Nomad's World in Australia, and the CEO of Nomad's World is quoted as saying that we make these young people think they're intrepid adventurers, mm-hmm. but in fact we provide everything on a plate.
That's right.
And it's a marketing technique which is very effective. They sell 1.5 million bed nights a year in Australia and Fiji and Vanuatu and other places. Mm-hmm. But the problem with that is that the money that they spend in Fiji with Nomad's World goes back to Nomad's World's bank account on Pitt Street in Sydney.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really help the people of Fiji very much.
Exactly. But then again, most backpackers still see themselves as separate from the tourism industry.
They do.
Is that just a mindset? Do we need to change that mindset?
The thing about backpacking and the reason why I wrote the book was because most people backpack once or twice in their lives, sensibly. You know, they go home and they get a job and a proper life, unlike myself.
But I need to find out how you do this for a living.
Yes, it's not easy. Well,
you wore shoes. You didn't wear slippers when you came in.
I know. I like backpacking because it gives you an independence, you know, and you can just decide to stay an extra night in a place because you like it, or get off a train mid-journey and see whatever it was that you just passed, and you do have that freedom. And I've also backpacked because I didn't get a proper job, and it's cheaper than going and staying in a Hilton on a beach somewhere.
I know a lot of people who will be thinking, you're crazy. The Hilton is more comfortable, you know. But we'll come to that a short while. Yeah.
I've stayed in a couple of Hiltons and they're lovely. But the problem with it, when you go to a city, how much time do you actually spend in the hotel?
That's true, but I think it really depends on the individual.
Yeah.
And what sort of travel you want.
Mm.
What's your idea of a holiday?
Yes, right? yes. And everybody can contribute to a local economy when they're traveling, except for the all-inclusive industry, mm-hmm. which we'll get to. But it's backpacking is nice just because I love the freedom of it. And I've ended up going back to places again and again, and I've seen that development. Most backpackers go once. In fact, most tourists, when they arrive in a place, that's what the place has always looked like. Their first impression is that that's what Goa has always looked like, mm-hmm. or that's what Koh Phangan has always looked like. And so they don't see the development of an area, and so they don't understand the impact that they're having. Now, you read a lot of things about the impact of mass tourism and the negatives of mass tourism, but nobody ever discusses the possibility of that happening within backpacking.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'd gone back to places again and again, I'd seen these things changing, and that's what prompted me to write the book.
Yeah. Right. And one of the things you also spoke about in the book is that, where backpackers have gone and opened up those off-the-beaten-track sort of areas,
yes.
You now see 5-star hotels.
You do, yeah.
4-star hotels. So what do we do then?
Well,
don't tell anyone.
Yeah, well, yes. There's
forget Lonely Planet.
Yeah.
And now you've got social media.
Yeah. Yes, and you have TripAdvisor and things like that. But you have to be a little bit careful because there was a guy, a travel blogger that I follow, and he killed his blog for me yesterday. He's in KL. I won't mention his name, but he's in KL. And he was writing about the hostel that he was staying in. And it was evident from the way that he was writing that he was getting a free night in return for a decent review.
Okay.
He's just destroyed his blog for me, which is ridiculous as a travel writer. You can't do that. You have to be independent.
Yeah.
As people are going back to...
how backpackers have actually opened up routes for mass tourism.
Yes, and the tourism industry keeps a very close eye on us because we are pioneers for it. We're not separate from it. We've always considered ourselves to be separate from it, but we're pioneers for it. If you take Koh Samui, which is the island off the southeast coast of Thailand, mm-hmm. you have in the 1970s, when the first backpackers arrived, it was a coconut farm. It was the most diverse coconut farm in the world. In fact, they had more different I didn't know there were different types of coconut, but there are, apparently, and they had more than anybody else. And now you have big boutique hotels. You mm-hmm. have an international airport. There's the good possibility you're going to get hit in the head by a jet ski if you know surface. It's completely changed, and it's because backpackers got there first and opened it up to other people. The other thing that's interesting about it is that the age range of backpackers has changed massively over the last just 10 years mm-hmm. because the backpackers who went out in the 1980s, early 1990s, came back and told their parents about how easy travel in Thailand or Malaysia or Southeast Asia was. And I met so many people on the research trip for the book who had just bought a Lonely Planet, got on a plane and gone, whereas mm-hmm. before they would have booked
through a travel agent.
Through a travel agent, yeah. And so there's this idea of something called a flash packer. And they're supposed to stay in sort of slightly more expensive hotels and stuff like that. But it doesn't actually exist. It's just people with jobs who are choosing a different way of traveling. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah.
Very
yeah.
interesting.
Backpackers expanded.
I want to come back and find out more about these leakages after the break. And meanwhile, as well, what is the cornerstone of responsible tourism? We'll come back and find out. If you have a question for Martin, send it through 016-201-9000. You can tweet to BFM Radio. We're discussing the backpacking industry, sustainable as well as eco-friendly tourism. A lot of us are contributing towards this footprint of tourism, especially now that air travel is so accessible. Send those questions through coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back. If you have just joined us, it is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasodhi, Martin Stevenson, journalist and travel writer with me. We're discussing voluntourism, the backpacking industry, sustainable and eco-friendly tourism. And what's the difference, Martin, with all those words? I mean, voluntourism, what is that?
Right. Voluntourism is, apart from being a very ugly mashing together of the words volunteering and tourism, mm-hmm. is the process whereby you pay to go out and volunteer on projects. Now, its origins are actually quite old, as much as 60 years old. You had academics who were out on archaeological digs or counting orangutans or whatever, and tourists would come up and the academics would think that they just want to observe and see what was going on. They'd invite them in. But then the tourists wanted to get involved. Mm-hmm. Now, academics aren't stupid by definition. And so they decided to start charging the tourists.
Right.
And it was a way of funding underfunded projects, you mm-hmm. know, the scientific research projects. And then in 1961, President Kennedy started the Peace Corps. And voluntary service overseas, which is the UK's version of that, started up as well. But those were, so the VSO, for example, requires 2 years postgraduate experience in a required skill for that specific project. But the voluntourism industry is much less picky about our skills. Give you an example. When I was 17, I called Oxfam to see if I could volunteer on one of their projects during the summer holidays. Mm-hmm. And the woman said, great, what do you do? Are you a doctor? Are you an engineer? And I was doing history of art, philosophy and law A-levels, which were no use to anyone, including me, it turned out, and especially not to Oxfam. And she suggested that I come back after my degree and when I've got some skills to offer them. But I said, "Yeah, can I do something else? Can I dig a well or can I help paint a school or something?" And she said, "Well, we can give a local person a wage to do that." Now, since then, the voluntourism industry that has sprung up is still digging wells and still painting schools, but some areas of the voluntourism industry care less about whether a local person might be able to earn a wage for it. To give you an example, there's one company, a British company, which last year was sending people out on a four-week tour of Vietnam, finishing with 2 weeks helping build wells for $1,930.
So you get paid for this?
No, they pay $1,930 for this trip.
Okay.
And it doesn't include flights or insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's generally the case in voluntourism. Now, I've got no problem with the desire people have to do something good. I mean, what could be better? It's great to give something back on their trip and all the rest of it. That's fantastic. But if the only ability you're bringing to this project is your ability to shovel dirt out of a hole, then, and with poverty usually being a driving force behind the need for these projects in the first place, when you have unemployed people in the local area, why aren't they doing it?
Exactly.
And you have people going out who can afford to pay $1,930 to do the job. It's not like they need the work.
Yep.
So that's one of the first problems with a lot of the projects that the big voluntourism companies organize. Now, it's important that we make the distinction between the big voluntourism companies, which are owned by holiday companies, the placement organizations, which are ethical and responsible, which send people to other countries, and the voluntourism opportunities which exist with small local projects within the country when you get there. Now, to one example that I cite in the book, I think it's all right to name names because I'll get sued before you are.
I publish this.
there's a big company called I2I, and they've been sending thousands of people out to volunteer for years. But what most of the volunteers don't know is that in 2007, I2I was bought for $30 million by First Choice Holidays, mm-hmm. which is the largest provider of packaged touring holidays in Britain. And First Choice Holidays is owned by TUI, which is a German company, which is the largest all-inclusive tourism provider in Europe. So what you're doing is you're actually paying a holiday company for the opportunity to go out and volunteer. Now, I have several problems with this. Because is the holiday company buying these, and First Choice happens to own several voluntourism organizations, and there's no mention of it on their website. Their websites make them look like they're a charity, in fact. But the problems I have with this are they buying these companies because they genuinely care about the work that they do, or are they just doing it to burnish their corporate social responsibility mm-hmm. image, or have they seen a very lucrative opportunity?
Yeah.
And one of the problems with the industry is it's not even lightly regulated, it's completely unregulated. So it's very difficult to find out how much money is actually being spent. But the figures range from anywhere between $1.5 and $2.5 billion a year are being spent by volunteers to go out and work on projects. And the question is, where does that money go?
Yep.
And when these are private holiday companies who are selling these packages, they don't have to really produce the financial information that would give volunteers a really good idea about how their money is being spent. If they're a charity, it doesn't guarantee good management, but it does guarantee a degree of financial transparency. When you go to I2I's website, you'll find a pie chart which says that 28% of the money you're spending is going on volunteer recruitment, which is just the company's marketing department.
Mm-hmm.
But they just slightly different wording, right. Slightly disingenuous wording, makes it look more charitable, more humanitarian.
So in your mind, what is the best way to actually execute voluntourism? Or should we not even bother?
No, we should bother. There's lots of projects and people and communities that can really benefit from people going out and doing something good, even if it's just at a simple financial level. But it's mostly about who is organizing the placement and the questions that volunteers ask while they're signing up for that placement. So I2I won't tell you when you're handing over your credit card details mm-hmm. that they're owned by a holiday company. They've
right.
got no reason, because you'd lose faith in them. There are fantastic placement organizations in Europe and in the States. There's one called People and Places in the UK, which is great. They've got a very ethical approach to it. Or when you arrive in country, you can find great little local projects where you can really do good stuff. In Cambodia, there's a guy called Michael Horton, who's wonderful. He's from Yorkshire, and he runs a Concert Cambodia. And tourists can go in and see him, and he'll match the skills that they have with a network of 60-odd projects around Siem Reap province, where the Angkor Wat temples are, which can really benefit from those skills. And whereas I2I will charge you $3,000 to go and do something, Michael Horton is less than $500.
Wow.
So it's also a lot cheaper.
There is a big difference, isn't it? But yeah. They also take into account employment for the local people before they actually bring in tourists, volunteers?
A very good example of this is with teaching. And Cambodia is a darling of the voluntourism companies at the moment. Cambodia has massive, massive problems. 30% of the population live under the poverty line, which is set at 61 US cents in Cambodia. Because of the horror of the Khmer Rouge, 50% of the population is under 25 years old. 25% is under 16. And during the Khmer Rouge period, 85% of teachers and 90% of doctors were killed, education being a threat. Mm-hmm. And so what Cambodia lacks is experienced, qualified professionals. And what they don't need is groups of young, inexperienced teachers coming up. What they need are teacher trainers. They need people who can come in and train local people to do the work themselves. And that's one of the principal things that ethical volunteering organizations focus on. Yes, it's making sure that you're enabling local people rather than perhaps imposing a Western agenda, what you think they should be doing. You know, I often wonder why somebody who lives in the northeast of Thailand, do they really need to be learning English?
Mm-hmm.
You know, isn't there something else that they ought to be learning given the life that they're going to lead there, you know, the irrigation or something like that? It would be far more beneficial for them. The idea that everybody in the world needs to learn English is utterly ridiculous. and I'm speaking as someone with a lot of English teaching experience as well.
So it's something like medical tourism, except for you're paying as well, mm-hmm. but you're volunteering your time, doing something, contributing towards the community.
Ideally, yes.
Hopefully.
Yes, hopefully.
Hopefully.
One of the reasons why it's become so popular with young people at the moment is that travel used to look great on a CV. You know, you come out of university with no work experience, but a year traveling around the world made it look like you had a little initiative.
Mm-hmm.
But so many people have traveled now that it doesn't actually look so good. So volunteering has replaced that. Okay, I spent 3 months teaching in an orphanage, mm-hmm. which is great. Also, interviewers now are yesterday's backpackers, so
yes.
They know that 6 months in India probably means 3 months getting drunk in Goa, and then 3 months on a camel in Rajasthan, and it's perhaps not quite what it used to be seen as. Yeah. So volunteering has kind of taken its place, and these big organizations, they can see that young people are ready to spend the money to add something to their CV.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's volunteerism. And then you have something called responsible tourism. An entirely different kettle of fish.
Several kettles. The problem with all of these various prefixes that people use to talk about tourism is that none of them really mean anything. Responsible tourism, sustainable tourism, ecotourism. There is no definition of it. The eco prefix is often used just to pull the wool over people's eyes. And Goa, for example, is trumpeting its eco credentials at the moment. And they're encouraging businesses to build eco-lodges along the Goan coast. But there's a species of turtle, the olive ridley turtle, and they can't find nesting grounds along the coast now as it is. So cluttering up an already, you know, very cluttered coastline, even if they are eco-lodges, mm-hmm. it seems, you know, it's not going to help the turtle.
I think you mentioned in the book some of our idea of ecotourism is switching off lights, not sending your bath towels for, you know, laundry
yeah.
as often as you should. Mm. It goes much beyond that.
It goes much, much beyond that. My main focus with the book is about the economics of tourism, really. I think that's what it all comes down to, making sure. The guidebooks talk about switching off the ceiling fan when you go out and being careful of how you dispose of plastic water bottles and so on, which is
great.
Yeah, it's not possible.
But it's not the be-all and end-all.
It's not the be-all and end-all. And it's, for me, responsible tourism is about knowing where your money is going, knowing where your money is ending up.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some very curious disconnects among tourists. We all know that when we go snorkeling or diving, we mustn't snap off a bit of coral and take it home with us. But as soon as we've finished our dive, we go to the market and we buy a pendant made out of red coral. It's fine for somebody else to go and snap it off and make it into a nice piece of jewelry. Mm-hmm. And yet that just doesn't get through. We're still buying the jewelry. We're still buying the pendant. And therefore, we're still encouraging people to go and gouge the coral out of the seabed.
Yeah, how many of us actually think that far?
That's the problem. That's the problem. The perhaps one of the most fundamental things in the book is it's not a very romantic idea, but what you have to do now as a tourist or a traveler of any stripe, backpacker or no, is place yourself in a queue based on the number of people that are just like you. Mm-hmm. So look at your demographic. So this is pretty much where I start the book. I'm sitting in a restaurant on the beach in Goa, and I'm looking around, and there are about 50 other backpackers in the restaurant. I know that Lonely Planet has about a 60% market share for guidebooks, so, you know, 30% of them are going to be carrying, you know, the Lonely Planet. Several of them look European, like me, on the beach, like me, following their Lonely Planet, like me. So I have to multiply everything that I do mm-hmm. by that number every day.
Yep.
So it's whatever I eat, whatever I buy, the money that I spend on my hostel and so on, is going to have to be multiplied by that number.
Yep.
And like I say, it's not a very romantic idea. It's not Lawrence of Arabia. But it is a realistic one now. And if we want our money to benefit local people, we have to think about about multiplying everything by the number of us who are now doing it.
As you said, you focus on the economics of travel, of tourism. Leakages is something that you feel very, very strongly about. What are these leakages?
Right. Leakage is something which is most often used in the package or all-inclusive tourism business. Now, leakage is an official term from the tourism industry. And leakage is about the amount of money that you spend on your holiday that doesn't make it to your destination, okay? Because everybody takes a cut. Travel agent takes a cut, airline takes a cut, hotel, the resort company takes a cut. If you take, for example, there's a big French holiday company, Club Med. Now, Club Med will send a family of four off to Martinique for 10,000 euros for a two-week holiday, mm-hmm. all-inclusive. Now, when this French family are flying out there, like I say, travel agent takes a cut. It's like if you imagine a tray of canapés or vol-au-vent making their way across a cocktail party.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, by the time the tray reaches the other side of the room, it's going to be virtually empty.
Yes.
And once each step have taken their slice of the money that you've spent, very little of it will end up in Martinique. And the average leakage for the tourism industry generally is about 70%. The average for the all-inclusive industry is 90%, because whereas the package tourist, they'll have breakfast in the hotel, then they'll go out and they'll have lunch in the main square, they'll have dinner in somewhere their friend recommended, and then they'll have a digestif in a bar, down by the sea. But whenever an all-inclusive holiday maker gets hungry or thirsty, they race back to the hotel, because back at the hotel it's free. Mm-hmm. They've already paid for it.
Yep.
And that's why Tourism Concern, which is an NGO in the UK which looks at these problems, they looked into Turkey, and they found that there was an all-inclusive village owned by one of the big hotel companies, and in the next door village called Sarigam, then the average spend of the people staying in the tourist village was €1 per guest per day.
Wow.
Was being spent in the next village.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other problems is that because the guests don't have to carry any cash with them, they rarely tip. And the hospitality industry is a very, very poorly paid industry, so they rely very much on tips.
Mm-hmm.
And so the all-inclusive industry, because the guests, they think everything's free, then the staff lose out as well.
Right.
And leakage is a massive problem. And what's lovely about it is that backpackers at the moment aren't prey to this kind of leakage, because they'll go in and they'll stay in, you know, the people who stay in Hilton will consider them flea pits, but it's the quality of the accommodation varies as you move around Asia. In Mumbai, $10 got me a room with partition walls but no ceiling and a shared bathroom. $15 in Vietnam got me a double room with ensuite bathroom.
Okay.
$15 in Siem Reap in Cambodia got me a double room with a bathroom, fridge, TV, and balcony. And $15 in Sydney, you can sleep in the bus stop.
Right.
Because it's not going to pay for anything.
The reason I'm cringing and laughing is because I am that mass tourist.
Okay.
You know, just the, you know, opposite of what you, you know, are advocating. But it sort of gets you thinking as to how you can change. Okay, for somebody like me, how can I start to contribute positively towards the places that I pass through? I'm not going to do drastic things like you are, Martin, but how can I start being more aware of it?
It all comes down to being aware of, like I said before, you're in a queue of people. Now, most of the time, if you're going on a package tour, if you're going on a city break, for example, then you're going to be doing pretty much the same as the locals do. Mm-hmm. I got a load of strife from a couple of German women in Vietnam because I had been traveling for 2 days. I couldn't find anything but soup. And by the time I arrived in Nha Trang, all I wanted was a burger. Excuse me. And so I ate a burger. And these two German women who had been lovely up until that point said, if you don't want to try local things, why don't you stay at home? And I really wanted to lead them by the hand to the nearest shopping mall and show them Burger King and KFC and all the rest of it. Because, you know, it's just like here.
Yep.
People love McDonald's.
They do.
You know, they don't spend their life eating beef rendang all the time. It's just, there's a bit of variety. So, but if you're on a city break, you're going to be doing much the same as the people of KL are doing. You know, if you're going to a resort, you're not going to go outside the walls very much. But if you do, exactly the same principle applies. How many of you are there? Who are just like you. Mm-hmm. And so how sustainable is this purchase when you multiply it by the number of people who are going to be following you?
Right.
It's basically a simple
just to
affair.
Be aware of that.
Yeah.
Be conscious about it.
Yes. Yeah.
How would you conclude, Martin, as far as voluntourism, responsible tourism, our footprint in the tourism industry?
Our footprint in the tourism industry. It doesn't matter what kind of traveller you are. We are going to have a footprint, and what we need is to disabuse ourselves of the idea that we can take only photographs and leave only footprints. This may have been true when Lawrence of Arabia was wandering around Palestine, but it's certainly not true now because there are so many of us out there. And when we consider how much we spend, I mean, if you look at, say, orphanage tourism in Cambodia, it's an absolute nightmare. There's a fantastic Al Jazeera documentary out there about how people go in with the best of intentions and the damage that they're doing to these children is absolutely awful. It's the problem with orphanages in Cambodia is that while public education is free in Cambodia, the teachers are paid so little that when the school kids turn up for school in the morning, they have to give a few riel to the teacher. Now, since 2005, tourism in Cambodia has increased by 80%. The number of orphanages has also increased by 80%. Now, has the number of orphans increased by the same number? Of course it hasn't. And about 70% of the orphans in Cambodia actually have at least one living relative. But the only way that families from very poor or rural backgrounds can guarantee their children education is to put them into residential care. And then you have you lower the costs by bringing in volunteers to teach them something, which is completely useless.
English,
because they have they have no experience whatsoever. They'll do a weekend long online teaching course, and it doesn't help anybody. But the big problem with orphanage voluntourism is that the children are sent out into the streets to befriend tourists, to bring them into the orphanages. The orphans are often kept in deliberately substandard conditions so that the tourists' heartstrings are tugged and the directors can solicit funds to make improvements, right, which are obviously never made because children lounging around on IKEA furniture playing PS3 don't raise much money.
No,
you know,
they don't. They don't. But yeah, point made. But your book is wonderful to read. How do we get a copy?
You can get a copy at morethanfootprints.com. All the links are there. Also, if people want to read up more about this volunteerism stuff, if you go to morethanfootprints.com/volunteering, then you'll find all the people in the places that I've mentioned today and links to the organizations that I've been talking about, and you can learn a lot more about it, because it's desperately important. It's desperately important that volunteers ask questions. The way to change the volunteerism industry is to get the information out to prospective volunteers so that they know the state of the industry, so that they can ask the right questions about where their money is going, whether they're going to be really helping.
Thank you very much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Martin Stevenson, journalist and travel writer on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.